Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On June 4th of 1800, Noah Webster, a sometime school teacher, a failed lawyer, and staggeringly successful spelling book author, took out an ad in the pages of a Connecticut newspaper just above notices of a sailor's death, a shoe sale, and a farmer's reward for a stray cow. The sailor had drowned, the cheap shoes were ladies' morocco, and the cow was red with a white face. Webster, who was 42, had this to say: he was busy writing a dictionary of the American language, and he wanted the world to know it. Joining us this hour is the author of Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. Arthur Schulman is our guest. Arthur is a retired cognitive psychologist and a veteran crossword puzzle creator. His puzzles have appeared in the New York Times for many years, and he has helped put this book together, and a fascinating one it is. What makes American English American? Are there substantial differences between the American and English language, and definitions of words back when this book was first published are just fascinating? They say a lot about the times in America and also a great deal about Noah Webster. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Arthur. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number if you'd like to send an email. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Arthur Schulman, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure being with you.
What a fascinating project you embarked on. It's so interesting, and I can't believe this man spent so many years compiling the dictionary.
Well, he was rather compulsive about it. He spent at least 20 years working on the dictionary, and it was a one-man project, which is even more amazing.
Yes, it is.
He had virtually no help. So one of the reasons it took so long is that he was waylaid after a few years into the project by the desire to show that all the words in the language derived from one primitive language, an Ur language that was spoken in the Garden of Eden. And so he learned many different languages, was surrounded by dictionaries of exotic languages like Ethiopian, and tried to find connections between the words and all the existing languages of the world.
It's probably best that he didn't have much help because he was quite a crabapple, wasn't he?
He didn't have many friends,
no.
as far as we can tell. I mean, his family seemed to like him, but he was not everybody's favorite, and he didn't even have very many friends among his political allies, the Federalists.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the considerable difference that he saw, and you, as a result of having done this book, see between the American and the English languages.
Well, I think his main drive for writing the book, for compiling the dictionary, was his observation, which was certainly a correct one, that all languages are living organisms and change over time. And that many new words are added to a language wherever the language is spoken, and so there had been Europeans in America since just after Columbus, and so many words had come into the language spoken by people on this side of the Atlantic, and in his time he realized that a lot of words had come into the language since before the Revolution. And he wanted a dictionary. He wanted to compile a dictionary that would define the language, the words in the language that were actually used by people in the country, whether they were colloquialisms or slang terms. However they were used, if they were used, he wanted to include them and define them.
Mm-hmm. So to him, being a patriot meant...
Certainly he was a supporter of the Revolution. He was born 250 years ago in 1758. And so when he was about 20, he was at Yale studying. And then he went into the service and when he came back, he really got to work doing many things, producing his path-breaking educational books, because he was really somebody who really wanted to improve public education in the United States. And so his Blueback Speller, which was only one part of his effort here, went through millions and millions of copies.
Oh my.
And was still being used in American schools as late as the early part of the 20th century.
No kidding.
Yeah. So it went on for quite some time, for about 100 years.
I would say that's quite some time.
Yeah.
And did he make a lot of money from that endeavor?
He made perhaps not nearly so much money as he should have, but he made enough money to support his later endeavors, at least in part. He was never rich. I mean, he married into a rich family, but most of the money that he got from that marriage was spent by his wife buying linens and stuff like that just after they were married. So he had to get another loan from his brother-in-law. And he went door to door trying to find subscribers to his prospective dictionary. And that was a very difficult operation. And his big dictionary, the 1828, from which our selection is derived, was expensive in its own time, and didn't sell an enormous number of copies, and didn't receive the acclaim it deserved until at least 15 or so years after it was published.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's hard to believe there was so much controversy surrounding the publication or the interest in putting together a dictionary. It was not a universally popular idea, was it?
Well, you know, I mean, even these days, there are people who would like to fix the language, to keep it the way it is, the way they remember it, the way they like it, and who object to new terms that are coming into the language. But in his time, people thought that, well, you know, even though we were already in the post-revolutionary period, the King's English or the Queen's English, it was the King's then, the King's English was good enough for them, and they didn't see any reason why a new dictionary should have to be written. And the new words that Webster was championing, they thought were corruptions of the language. So we didn't need those words, and there's no reason to call them to anybody's attention.
You have said that you were intrigued by how much he revealed about his religious beliefs, personality, and the times in which he lived via the word definitions that he wrote. And they are fascinating to read, aren't they? His philosophy, his beliefs are right there.
That's right. It's on his sleeve. It's on the
print
page.
Right.
And they're all over, even in places where you would not expect to find them. I mean, so his moralism is just permeates the dictionary, and I mean, I was always glad to see what Ambrose Bierce, the American writer and cynic, how Ambrose Bierce felt about Webster, and Bierce defines faith as belief without evidence in what is told by one who speaks without knowledge of things without parallel. And I think he had Webster in mind when he wrote that definition. But Webster has all of these definitions of words in which he is exhorting people to raise their children properly, to educate them, to have children obey and defer to their superiors and to their parents. There are things that he strongly objects to on a moral basis, and he tells you so. So that's one thing that you immediately see as you begin to browse this great dictionary. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are all kinds of other things that make it a great dictionary. So that even if it didn't have any of the moralisms, I think it would be worth going through and getting to know better.
Shows his politics as well. Big fan of George Washington. No love lost between Webster and Thomas Jefferson, of all people. Why?
Yeah, well, for a number of reasons. So one, for religious reasons, because Jefferson and quite a few of his contemporaries were deists, and for Webster, that meant that he really was a non-believer. He didn't believe in revelation. And Webster just couldn't tolerate that. So that and Jefferson at one point thought that Webster was really second rate as a thinker, but that's another story. In any case, Webster was opposed to Jefferson because of Jefferson's religious beliefs, or non-beliefs, according to Webster, but also because Webster was a Republican, and Webster was a diehard Federalist, about the last of the Federalists. In fact, his book was published in the year that Andrew Jackson was elected president, which was really sounded the death knell of Federalism. And the Republicans wanted to make the country more democratic in fundamental political ways. And Webster was very leery of that, especially after the French Revolution, in which he could see all of the excesses carried out by the Jacobins and their followers. And he was afraid that the same kind of thing was going to happen here if we were too careless about dispensing democratic rule.
Mm-hmm. What prompted you? You've said that you knew about this dictionary for a long time, but never really had looked into it. And then you did. You'd browse dictionaries. You found one of his that was in a very good condition. But what prompted you to carry on your own research and doing a book about this? What was so fascinating about it to you?
Well, as you say, even most people who have been browsing dictionaries all their lives, like myself. I've probably never really looked into Webster, because you don't find the 1828 Webster in public libraries, by and large. Mm-hmm. So they're just not going to be there. And you have to go out of your way to find them in the depths of university libraries or other kinds of places like that. And so I'd never done that. So I knew about the dictionary, but I didn't know how Webster actually defined words until I wandered into this local used bookstore in Charlottesville and found this facsimile edition on the shelves there. I bought it, and I started going through it, and I was just entranced by it. Now, it's not an accident that this facsimile edition exists, because it is published by an evangelical Christian group in eastern Virginia, and it has been published for 40-odd years. And people, especially people who do homeschooling, are attracted by this dictionary, which the publishers of this feel is more suitable to the raising of their children than all of the dictionaries that followed it.
Oh, my.
And so as soon as I brought it home, I started going through it, and I decided that I really needed to produce a compilation, a selection from this great dictionary, because I thought that other people would be as entranced by what they find there as I was. I knew about early attempts to do this with Samuel Johnson's great dictionary of 1755, and I thought that Webster would be at least as interesting, especially if I could provide an introductory essay on Webster and his time.
Right.
Well, I never did that myself, and it wasn't until 2 years ago when Jill Lepore, the great early American historian at Harvard, published a piece in The New Yorker called Noah's Mark, that I said, that's my introduction. And I got in touch with her, and she agreed to collaborate on this, and the rest is history.
Yeah, isn't it great?
She fell out of the sky for me. It's just wonderful.
Yeah. So are there huge, substantial – well, no. The question I wanted to ask is Sam Johnson's dictionary as interesting to you as Noah Webster's or not?
In a very different way. Johnson was a great – was a great definition writer. He was a great stylist. He also was a literary man of his time, so he knew just about everything that was important or interesting in English literature. So he worked pretty much by himself, but he had help. But he had at his fingertips even in memory, quotes from all of these marvelous sources, which he used to illustrate the usage of the words that he defined. And so, I mean, he could do that in a way that nobody before or since has been able to do. Now, Webster himself tried to provide quotes that would illustrate usage, and he tried to come up with as many from American authors as he could, but he was obliged to use many of the same quotes that Johnson had used in his 1755 dictionary.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. Our lines are all open if you'd like to join us. Arthur Schulman is our guest. He has written a fascinating book, Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. Arthur is a retired cognitive psychologist. He's a veteran crossword puzzle constructor. His puzzles have appeared in the New York Times for many years. So here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. October of this year marked Noah Webster's 250th birthday, and it's a very, very interesting look at the times, certainly, and his definitions are real interesting to read because of the political viewpoint, the moralistic viewpoint, et cetera, and his life is fascinating as well. So we're talking about all of that this hour. And, you know, if you want to join us by phone, we'd certainly like to have you call us, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Arthur Schulman is our guest. The book is Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. We start our calls with Tommy. Hi, Tommy. No, I got to press the button right, I think. Hello, Tommy. Are you there? Hello?
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I'm curious if you could give us some examples of the kinds of moralisms that Webster used in his definitions. I'd be interested to hear exactly how he said them.
Okay.
Okay, I can give you one in which the moralism comes in the middle of the definition. He has a long definition for marriage, and he defines marriage as follows. Marriage was instituted by God himself for the purpose of preventing the promiscuous intercourse of the sexes, for promoting domestic felicity, and for securing the maintenance and education of children.
Huh.
So there's an example of how he gets around to telling you the reasons for a particular institution and why one should be doing particular things.
Very excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. There are a lot of instances of words that I was reading through, and I think, oh, this ought to be revived. And I'm wondering if you're doing that, Arthur, that every now and then in your speech something pops up that was in his dictionary that we don't use anymore, but you thought it was a marvelous definition, a marvelous word.
Yeah, well, one of my favorites is empiricism, which is a word that's familiar to most psychologists and philosophers and academics. It just means that you deal with the world as you find it, with your experience. Back in Webster's time, empiricism meant something quite different. It meant the practice of medicine without a medical education.
Oh, yeah, quite different.
Hence, quackery, the pretensions of an ignorant man to medical skill. And in his time, that was really the case.
Huh.
There were lots of people going around with their bedside manners trying to persuade patients that they knew what they were talking about and could actually help them, when in fact they had a very small bag of tricks.
The word lengthy, it was controversial to include that one. I had no idea lengthy could be a word that would be controversial.
Well, you know, people didn't like neologisms. A lot of them didn't. In fact, lengthy was put down as saying, "Well, what's next, strengthy?" You know. that came into the language. That was already in the language, and other dictionaries picked it up very soon after that. So the objectors to that particular word didn't succeed. Mm.
And I think we've talked about how many words were in his dictionary and how many words you selected for yours.
Yeah, well, there were about 70,000 in his dictionary, which is more than Johnson had in his 1755 dictionary. Mm-hmm. And our selection is a little over 1,500. I would have liked a few more, but I think I could produce another 1,000 probably that were close to the ones that were included in their interest. But there are just lots of interesting things to find, and people can find them if they get the original.
Well, that was quite a job for you to go from 70,000 to 1,500. So your selection process was.
My selection process was to glom on to those words that I thought were especially interesting in various ways, and that I thought would be interesting to other people who were interested in language, were interested in dictionaries and styles of definition. And I was confident that there would be other people out there like me who would revel in what they would find in Webster. So there were lots of reasons for inclusion. The moralisms are one obvious thing, but certainly by no means the only thing. Webster was interested in science and defined a host of new scientific terms. He was especially interested in rocks and minerals, and there are many more of those than most readers will have patience to read. I included just a couple for examples. So those are not the most fun to read because you need to be an expert in mineralogy in order to decipher the definitions. There are also some very attractive definitions in which he inserts himself into the definition. That is, he didn't spend much time in Europe, but when he was there, he went to particular places, observed particular things, and he manages to get those experiences into some of his definitions. I don't have many of them. I don't have any of them, I think, at hand, but you can find quite a few of them in going through the dictionary.
He wrote the last word in England, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, so he finished up. He had to go there in order to have access to things that he didn't have access to in this country.
Uh-huh. Let's go to Duane next. Hi, Duane.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. That's sort of a little bit off the track, but you mentioned the crossword puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
I've been wondering for years, and I tried to get an answer to a different place and haven't found it, but they're always symmetrical. Is that just some kind of a convention?
Yes, it is
almost always.
It's a convention, and the kind of symmetry is also conventional, and there isn't any there's no other reason for it. It's just that's the way it developed in this country, and that's the way it's always been. Once in a great while, the symmetry is very slightly relaxed because the current editor Will Shortz, who does a wonderful job, I think, sees that. That what the constructor of the puzzle is trying to accomplish needed to have a grid that wasn't quite symmetrical in the usual sense. But ordinarily, the grid is such that if you turn it upside down, it looks the same.
Yeah. Hmm.
And that's just a convention.
Do you do the puzzles, Duane?
Not a lot, but I've just noticed that for years, and I'm just curious, and I couldn't figure out any reason for it, but I couldn't find any place where I could... Any place where I could find an answer.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you very
much.
You
got the guy. Thanks very much for the call. What about the definitions? Have they stayed with us, or are they quite different, Arthur?
Well, I think his definitions were good enough to be retained and sometimes just elaborated on in later editions, and even unto the modern-day Merriam-Webster's. One of the things that Webster was especially good at was at illustrating subtle differences in meaning between words that we think of as synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And before him, there really wasn't an attempt in dictionaries to do that kind of thing. These days, we take synonymies for granted, even in desk dictionaries. But Webster was really doing that on a large scale for the first time and was very good at illustrating the differences in meaning between words that are nearly the same, but not quite the same in meaning.
Mm-hmm. He was also involved in politics himself, wasn't he, Webster?
Yep. Yeah, he was a newspaper man. He wrote columns. These days they would be op-ed pieces. But even more than that, because he started a newspaper of his own. So he was writing pieces for the revolution, and then for the Federalist programs.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the politics, I mean, he did other kinds of things as well. When he was about 40, he came out with a book. This is just at the turn of the 19th century, just around 1800. He came out with a major work on epidemiology. And you can tell that he had the interest in that from some of the definitions in the dictionary, because he goes out of his way to talk about things like yellow fever and some other epidemics that have occurred in history.
And what was? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's thought.
Okay. I can't remember why he was in touch with Benjamin Franklin, with the relationship the two of them had. What's that story?
Well, you know, of course, Franklin was an earlier generation, and so he was a very important figure for just about everybody, and not only in our young country, but abroad. He was about the most popular American in Europe at the time of his death. One of the things that Webster was able to do was to find lots of quotes from Franklin's writings to illustrate the usage of the terms that he defined.
Mm-hmm.
So Franklin was one of his favorite Americans to quote. So were the authors of the Federalist Papers. But there weren't that many Americans that he could really seize upon for good quotes. So we had to fall back on the standbys, not only Shakespeare, of course, but at people like Addison and other English writers.
Oh, Shakespeare's a good standby, don't you think?
Yeah.
Not bad. And John Adams as well?
Oh, yes. John Adams is quoted frequently. Yeah.
But he didn't want to quote. Did he quote any British writers?
Oh, yeah. He quoted many British writers, and most of the quotes that he got, he presumably got from Johnson. So he just picked up the same quotes that Johnson had used.
And he included a number of Indian words. Tell me why he decided to do that.
Well, he actually missed some, which I didn't talk about in the book, but that's another story. Some of the Indian terms that had come into the language had come in very early. Terms like wampum and squaw. So all he had to do, I think, was to sit around and think about all of those Indian terms and then define them. He actually missed some. He missed more than he would be glad to know about. But he really tried to include them all. Moccasin is included, for example. All of these very common terms they were in use for. Some of them for hundreds of years at the time that he wrote his dictionary.
And what about spelling? Did you find really substantial spelling differences in words that we still use frequently today or not?
Well, early on, Webster, along with Franklin, were radical spelling reformers. They wanted to reform English American spelling so that words would be spelled the way they were pronounced, okay? In the end, people like that had to give up on that enterprise as just an impossible dream. So Webster really stopped crusading for that. There are very few spellings in his 1828 dictionary that we would regard as strange today. But by that time, he'd already eliminated almost all of the usual Britishisms. For example, the words that the Brits end with O-U-R, he would spell just with O-R. And I think most of the I-Z-E's would be I-S-E's.
Mm-hmm.
suffixes. He still has a few, and really just I think a few handfuls of words that have idiosyncratic spellings. Idiosyncratic. I mean, he spelled them that way. Just about nobody else did, and those spellings didn't catch on, and nobody paid much attention to them after that. But by and large, the spellings are spellings that we would recognize today as our spelling.
And Arthur, when the dictionary was published, who used it, and what was the response to the publishing? Were people, did they change their minds once they saw it?
I don't know the history of its use very well in those early days. As I said, it didn't sell very well.
Mm-hmm.
Not that many people bought it. He certainly didn't make money on it. But it was there in major institutions. It was certainly there in college and university libraries, and undoubtedly in some other public libraries. And you know, gradually the critics came around to saying that this was really an extraordinary accomplishment, and people tended to agree. Now, the rights to the book were bought by the Merriam Company, I think about 10 or so years after 1828, and they continued to publish revisions of the original work, and continue to this day, so that the Merriam-Webster Third International is a direct descendant of Webster's 1828.
Wouldn't he be amazed to know that?
Yeah, and some of his original definitions are still there verbatim. I mean, it's hard to find. I mean, you'd have to go back and forth to check. But sometimes when you look up a word in the new dictionaries, and then you check back to the 1828, you find that the definitions remain unchanged.
Uh-huh. You know, I would have thought that there would have been, I had no idea there were as few dictionaries as there were. You would think that it would be natural for people to write definitions of words for scholarly work, for just knowing what words meant, that not as many people were reading and writing, certainly, but that it would be a natural thing to evolve, and that a lot of people would have done that.
That's an interesting observation. We didn't really have dictionaries as we know them until the 17th century, when at least in the English language, in the English speaking world. And then the first ones were rather primitive, in that they were merely lists of words, hardly defined at all. And the first dictionaries were dictionaries primarily of what they called hard words, words that you wouldn't ordinarily, that you wouldn't use very often. They weren't the simplest words that everybody knew and everybody used.
Mm-hmm.
They thought there was no need to define those. There were a few of those dictionaries in the first half of the 17th century. And things really didn't get rolling towards dictionaries that we could recognize today as, you know, being written in the same spirit as ours until the 18th century, when Johnson's, of course, was the great achievement. But even before Johnson, there were one or two dictionaries, especially one by somebody named Nathan Bailey, was quite an interesting work and did more than try to define hard words.
We're welcoming more phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. Arthur Schulman is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That's talk@wpr.org. Arthur is a retired cognitive psychologist and veteran crossword puzzle constructor. His puzzles have appeared in the New York Times for many years. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to more of your phone calls now. Anne from Madison is next. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Well, being an obsessive compulsive myself, I have a bunch of dictionaries and assorted languages. And when I was trying to wade through a medical book on cancer, a lot of medical terms were, you know, I had no idea the meaning of, and all I needed was Webster's New World Dictionary and the Oxford Universal Dictionary. They're both relatively short, and there were a lot of medical terms in the Oxford Universal Dictionary, but Webster's New World Dictionary was elegant and very concise. It had good enough derivations to, you know, to be interesting. So I think it's a great, you know, Webster does a pretty good job. But the only real problem is, and I don't know whether Webster invented this, the Webster's dictionary, as I think all American dictionaries do, doesn't use the international phonetic alphabet. It uses a system that I think Webster might have invented himself, and it's never been adapted to the international phonetic alphabet. So, you know, I think it should be. I think that's a, you know, that would make Americans a little bit more better spellers, maybe.
Well, I think the Webster's that you're talking about is not one of the Merriam-Webster's, even though it's a good dictionary. And I think that the Merriam-Webster's today do use the international phonetic alphabet. But I'm glad to hear you're saying is what you can find in different dictionaries, because you know the people who make up the definitions for any dictionary today or in the past had to have a particular style, and they had to make some selections based upon what they thought should be included and what they were good at. And different dictionaries do better jobs than others in certain respects. And I think it's interesting to find out how they do it and which ones do the things that one is most interested in best.
Thank you, Ann, for the call. How many dictionaries do you have, Arthur?
Oh, I probably have about 100.
Huh.
And I've gotten more interested lately in some others. My favorite dictionaries are the Webster's Second International. The Merriam-Webster's Second International is a great favorite of mine. But then I like, as desk dictionaries, there's an English dictionary called the Chambers English Dictionary, which for years has been a bible for crossword aficionados.
Huh.
But it's also a dictionary that has a sense of humor. And so there are words defined in Chambers that would not be defined that way in any other dictionary. For example, eclair is defined as a cake, long in shape but short in duration.
Nothing like a dictionary with a sense of humor.
And so they do a lot of that. And it must be great fun to work on the staff of Chambers,
sure,
concocting definitions like that. And then what proper nouns get included, if they get included at all, is a corporate decision these days. And it's interesting to see which proper nouns get included in some dictionaries and not in others. Definitional style varies a great deal.
Right.
The Webster's Third International, which is the current unabridged that Merriam-Webster published, was written under the was compiled under the direction of a man who seemed to insist that commas should be avoided at all costs in the definition. So you have these impossibly long sentences, especially for scientific terms, that are almost incomprehensible. I mean, you can't figure out what it's all about. It's almost worse than reading a German text in which you have to wait until the end to get to the verb.
Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You mentioned two things that I kind of wanted to tie together. I didn't want to, but I saw how they might tie together. You're a linguistics professor?
No, I'm a psychologist.
Oh, okay. Are you familiar with George Lakoff?
Yes.
And how he describes how words are used, especially in politics today, and I'm wondering if how that applied to Webster because of the disagreements that he had with politicians of the time. Do you think that the way he used words, or maybe had a you know, how he wanted to define words and so on and so forth. Do you think that had anything to do with his dictionary or even his writing?
I'm not sure how to answer that because I think they surely did in some sense. I mean, Lakoff's approach is more subtle, and I don't think that some of the subtleties would have occurred to Webster in his time. But surely, when Webster tried to define terms like democracy, he was sensitive to how democracy could be corrupted and misused, and so he was. He would be careful in how he would define terms like that, and you would very often see his own, at least from our standpoint, see his own political point of view interjected into the definition.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email. Does anyone produce a dictionary of English that separates words by roots, Latin words in one chapter in the dictionary, French in another, and so forth? Why would we want this? It would help us choose words that work well together. It would make the writer or speaker more credible.
I can't cite them. I can't give you examples, but they exist. So there are etymological dictionaries that just go through the whole corpus of words in the language. But there are other sources, I'm sure, that do just what you have asked about. So that the words are separated according to their language of origin. But I can't really point you to particular sources, but you mm-hmm. can find them.
Do you speak a lot of languages or read a lot of languages, Arthur?
Unfortunately, I'm monolingual. It's been my biggest regret ever. The only languages I ever studied when I was in college and in high school were Spanish and German, mm-hmm. and I was actually pretty good at reading them, but I never got to speak them in an adequate way. These days, I've been sitting in on a Yiddish class.
Really?
But that's been more fun than conducive to my becoming a Yiddish speaker. I can read a little bit better now than I once was able to.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not. I would love to be able to read some of my favorite writers in the language in which they wrote,
mm-hmm.
and I can't really do that.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
Some of my favorite writers are the great Italian writer Italo Calvino, writing in Italian.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to read some of Nabokov in his early works mm-hmm. in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to read the works of the late French writer Georges Perec in the original French.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to speak Italian. Don't you think
you'd
go through?
Yes. Oh,
that'd be
yes.
so much
it's a wonderful
fun.
Language.
Yeah,
yes.
it is. So expressive. Yeah. You go through life, I think, happier, maybe.
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can do things in different languages. I mean, there's a hypothesis by a famous linguist named Worf, which argued that language constrains thought. Okay,
mm-hmm.
but what you could think about would be influenced by the nature of the language that you spoke,
mm-hmm.
and it's a difficult hypothesis to find evidence for because you don't really know what to look for. But what we know from vocabulary is that some languages like English have a much larger vocabulary than let's say the vocabulary that exists in French. Which is not to say that you can't say more or less the same things in English and French,
mm-hmm.
but there are many more words in English, and in Yiddish it turns out that there are hundreds of words for foolishness, okay, for narishkeit in Yiddish, and almost as many for mishigas, for craziness. And of course the Eskimos are supposed to have more words for snow than other
right.
languages, even though that's more questionable. Okay,
yeah.
So different languages do different things
right.
and have focused on different things and must affect the
sure.
way that the users of those languages
sure.
Come to think about the world.
Yeah, Bob from Eau Claire is next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I was just curious about one thing here. Well, you know the extent of literacy in that early 1800s or 1800s, and based on that, who were these early dictionaries directed towards? Who was the market? A few intellectuals or academics? Or was there enough illiteracy in the population that you'd have something like a large number of sales? Do you have any information on literacy in those days?
I don't really have any figures, but obviously, it took a long time for public education to develop, even on the secondary school level here in the United States. And so I don't know the extent of literacy in the new republic. And of course, in England, it was not many. Well, very very few people actually went to college or to university. And I'm not sure how many people could actually read and write. I don't know what the percentages were.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's a smaller percentage than exists in our time today, but I really don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you, Bob, for your call. Tony is next from Juneau. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. Say, hi, Arthur. I love this topic, being a dictionary collector.
Oh!
Anyway, I just wanted to let you know, and anyone else that's really interested in dictionaries, that there's a catalog of dictionaries and word books and texts by Vansel, David E. Vansel. It's an out-of-print book, but you could find it on eBay or something like that. And in that book, by the way, there is some older dictionaries than from the 16th century. You know, there's from 1440, there's a glossarium. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Glossarium, Harmonies, and lots of other vocabularies, but I understand that in the context of dictionaries, you know, when they didn't alphabetize them and things like that, there's more like word list stuff when you start to get older than the 17th and 16th centuries. And so, anyway, this is one of my favorite topics in the world. I have a few thousand dictionaries.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm a little crazy when it goes to dictionaries.
A few thousand dictionaries?
Well, I've had a couple thousand for, I don't know how many, 10, 15 years now, so I really have no idea how many I have. Now, you don't count them too often, but I love dictionaries. So.
You know, there's an organization called the Dictionary Society of North America.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
What do they do?
It's a scholarly. I have never been to one of their meetings yet, but I'm hoping to go to one this coming late spring in Bloomington, Indiana.
I would think you'd be the guest speaker.
Well, I'm hoping to give a paper there, yeah.
Right, oh, great. What do you do with all these dictionaries, Tony? They just grace your bookshelves or what?
Well, I love to collect knowledge, and there's no better way to understand the books you're reading than to have dictionaries available that can, you know, define every term that's in all these books. And since I read books that are on lots of different sciences, I collect different subject dictionaries. So I have approximately 800 different subject dictionaries, and you can go directly to the subject that you need and read about the book, you know, to help you with the book you're reading.
Huh.
Yeah, and one thing that was the case for Webster is as he was compiling his dictionary, he was standing in the well of a circular table with a hole in it, okay? And he was surrounded by the sources that he was using to find the words that he wanted to define. And many of the sources that he was using were technical books, but books on scientific topics. He had a book on rocks and minerals. He had a book on chemistry and so on. He knew he wasn't going to be able to do it without those significant references at hand.
Right. Thank you so much, Tony. I'd count the books today. You got to let people know how many you have, right? Be a good thing to do this afternoon. Thanks so much for your call. When you were a kid, did you read dictionaries from A to Z? Did you just go through the definitions?
No. In fact, I don't remember when I had my first dictionary. Fortunately, I grew up in Brooklyn in New York. And what I remember is spending a lot of time at the Brooklyn Public Library. But I was always interested in words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, as far as the crosswords are concerned, which really have nothing to do with the Websterisms, I was making up crosswords before I was solving them.
Huh.
So, you know, so it's been 50 years since I've had puzzles in the Times and in other sources.
Hmm. Thank you. It was a great hour. I enjoyed it. Thanks, Arthur.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Arthur Schulman, the book is Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. And that would be Noah Webster. The book is just published by Free Press. And Arthur is a retired cognitive psychologist. He's a veteran crossword puzzle constructor. His puzzles have appeared in the New York Times for many years. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, as always, for your calls and contribution to the show. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11, talking about current issues and interesting topics, and hope you'll join us then. And there are many hours ahead of great conversation right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11 o'clock on this, almost said Thursday, it's Wednesday morning, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.